Hi, this is Rob Nesbitt, aka Nezzy, and this is the Nezzy on Brass podcast. This is a very special edition of the podcast, particularly for me, as I have the pleasure of talking to one of my all-time favourite conductors, the highly respected James Scott. I first encountered him when he took Tredegar to a local band contest at Ebervale in 1994. He chose John McCabe's Cloud Catcher Fells as the own choice test, and it was the best performance I've ever been involved with. I've never seen a band elevate themselves so much, and it was all to do with his sheer charismatic approach combined with the band's absolute respect. I recently attended the pre-contest dinner for the British Open in Birmingham this September, kindly hosted by Martin and Karen Mortimer. One of the other guests was James Scott, and I was delighted to meet him again after such a long time. He kindly agreed for me to visit him and his lovely wife Denise at their home in Heswall on the Wirral. Without further ado, here is the interview. You were born on the 29th of March 1925 into a musical family, one of three children, to Archie and Annie Scott at Brackley Street, Farnworth in Bolton. Archie was in the bass section of Bess's of the band and used to attend rehearsals with him. What were those early days like at home, and what were your impressions of your trips to Bess's?
First of all, I remember transport was nothing like today. In fact, I remember first going, I would be 7 years old, 1932, that's right. And my dad took me, Bess's were due that year to go to Canada to play in the National Exhibition. They were rehearsing on Sunday mornings. I remember once walking, because there was no transport on the Sunday morning. My dad was carrying his E-flat bass on a bike. That was amazing. And it was several miles, you know. But anyway, that was my first introduction to Bess's band. I think it's still the same band room as far as I know. Because I talked to Roy Newsom when he had Bess's about this. Going up the stairs, and my dad sat me on a big wicker basket, a couple of feet tall and very wide. And it was actually the basket that they used when they went on world tours.
Oh, right.
For all the music. All the music was carried in these. And he sat me on there. I can see it now. The band at one end, I was sat near the door on the other end. And they started rehearsal. And the musical director hadn't arrived. And the man who started it, his name was Samuel Pyatt. And he was the ex-principal cornet who did the world tours with Alexander Owen in the beginning of the century.
Well,
yes. That was my introduction to the band world, really, because that was the Bess's of the band who were a real name in those days.
Yeah, they were.
In fact, in 1931, when I was six, they won the Bellevue on... I don't remember the occasion, of course, except to say I distinctly remember my mother, who went to Bellevue on that day with my aunt. They were sisters, and they came back, and I was playing in the front of my granddad's house. And they came back and said, "Your daddy's band has won." And I was playing outside. So then these were the introduction.
Enoch Jackson was the principal cornet player then.
Oh, he was.
And I think he had a bit of an influence on you with regard his solo playing.
Oh, yes, indeed. This is something else that I recall very easily. Bess's band were... I have a feeling it was the same year. Bess's band... I know I hadn't started playing anyway, so I must have been seven. Bess's band were engaged to play in a department store in Piccadilly, Manchester. It must have been a promotional type thing, I suspect. I think it was three short programmes each day for a week. Anyway, my dad took me on one of the days. I can see it now, Enoch Jackson playing a cornet solo. And he got up, no music. I've forgotten, unfortunately, what he played. But anyway, it was a typical triple tongue polka, I think. But he was quite a showman. And he walked from one side of the stage to the other during the duties before he started playing. No music. And I said to my father, I said, "I want to do that." that lit the fire for me.
Yeah.
We've all had moments, I think, like that, when we've heard wonderful artists.
So when did you get your first cornet, and who gave you your initial lesson?
Well, actually, it was my dad. He gave me my first lessons. And I started on my 8th birthday. I came home from school. I was near enough from school to go home for lunch in those days. So I used to run home at lunchtime. And on this day, my birthday, 8th birthday, yes, I got in the house and my dad was sitting there with a cornet in a box. I always remember, a wooden box. Not the fancy cases, really.
No.
No, a wooden box. And there was a cornet. So that was my first, on my 8th birthday. And Dad gave me my first few lessons. And after that, I had one or two lessons with one of his best friends, you know, cornet players. So that set me on the way.
Your first band was Ellen Brook and Boothstown?
That's right. Ellen Brook and Boothstown, which was just not far down the road on the tram. I was 9 then. I couldn't have been there long, about a year. My dad had left Bessis by that time. He'd started running his own business, so he was a builder.
All right.
He later became a miner, but my grandfather was a builder, you see, so it sort of followed his footsteps, half and half. Sort of. So my dad took me to Ellen Brook and Boothstown. I wasn't there about a year, I think. Anyway, 1935, he joined Aiken-Spurrow Band, and he took me with him. I mean, I started having lessons with a cornet player called Clifton Jones. Yeah. Famous name he was. He played solo cornet for Erwell Springs Band, who had been a previous national champions in the 20s, I think. And he taught me, because I remember asking him on the first few pages of the album, I knew that he'd played Carnival of Venice. And I asked him if he'd play it for me. Of course, I'd only been playing a couple of years there. And of course, he was a very good player. He played it for me. I remember that distinctly, you know. And that was another occasion I thought, I'd love to play that. You know? And all those years later, with Manon Feltons, I recorded it. To go back to what I was getting from Enoch Jackson, you see, this is why, what prompted me, I was determined I would always be a soloist, a proper soloist. In other words, playing without music. If somebody can play a piano for half an hour, playing a whole concerto, why can't I just play for 4 minutes or 5 minutes with that? And that was my view.
Yeah, I've never looked at it that way.
Yes. So all these things clicked, which made me follow my dream, which was to be a soloist.
Yeah. And you did it.
I managed it in the end, yes.
It was with Eccles Band that you experienced your first open on Dr. Keith Lee's Northern Rhapsody.
Oh, yeah.
I bet that was a day to remember, wasn't
it? Oh, yeah. Northern Rhapsody, the jazz piece, Thomas Keith Lee. I was 10. I was right at the end of the line, of course, third cornet. My teacher was conducting Clifton Jones. Black Dyke won. Surprise.
Soon after, you took part in your first nationals at the Crystal Palace.
That's right, yes.
Again, a memorable day. Can you describe the event and what was it like playing in the Crystal Palace, especially for a brass band competition?
Well, as I remember it, it was very open, similar to Bellevue, with the audience fairly near to you. And, of course, to a 10-year-old boy, the whole place was immense, which it was, really, the Crystal Palace. I can just remember walking up the steps with my father and entering this vast space. And we played Pride of Race. I remember the evening concert. Foden's had won previously 3 times. 32, 3 and 4. So they were above the 5. And so Mun and Foden's won. I remember standing with my dad. They came on stage to do the lap of honour, which was done in those days. I said to my dad, oh, I'd love to play with that band. Well, being a 10-year-old boy, I was probably more influenced by the wonderful uniform they had in those days, because none of Felton's had a unique, in those days, fully military. It was a copy of a Hussars regiment. Austrian knots all the way across here in gold, and thick red stripe down the trousers. And being a shoe factory, of course, man and Felton's, they all had shoes made in the company. William Halliwell conducted them, and they'd only been in existence 2 years, you know. Oh, and I said, they were started in 1933, but they got a lot of good players together. But they won on Pride of Race. I said to my dad, as I say, I'd love to play with that band. And of course, 12 years later, I joined them.
That's right.
Oh, I was 22 years old when I joined. I often wonder, I wouldn't be surprised if I'm not the only person alive who played in the Crystal Palace top section in 1935.
There won't be many. You were on the move again at the age of 12 when your father moved to Griff Colliery in Nuneaton.
That's right, yes.
I believe you joined the Ibstock band, which later became Desford Colliery.
That's correct, yes. When I joined Ibstock, I was 13. I used to go on the bus every weekend from Nuneaton to Ibstock. Come to think of it, I used to stay there the weekend. I used to go on a Saturday and stay with the euphonium player in the band. Mr. Measures, his name was, yes. And I used to stay in his house with him and his wife for the weekend, practice Sunday morning. And I was, how old would I be? 13 years old. And I was principal cornet of Ibstock.
Good grief. What section were they in?
I think it was third section.
Yeah, because
I think it was third section.
Ibstock's Leicestershire, isn't it?
Leicestershire it is.
It is, yeah, because my very first band was Wigston Temperance Band in 1966.
Leicester. I have a feeling that they were a little bit below Wigston, because I remember my teacher there then was Thomas Underwood, who was a conductor of Ibstock. And he used to tell me about Wigston Band. They were quite a good band in those days.
Oh, I wouldn't know. I don't go about that far.
When I say goodbye band, I mean, to be at Ibstock, they were a little bit above us.
Right.
So I think they were in something like the second section, you know, we were in the third section.
Yeah. Soon after, you were invited to join the City of Coventry band on the end chair, age 15.
Yes.
Was that an enjoyable period?
Oh, yes. Yes. I joined second man, first of all. I can't remember who was solo cornet. I have a feeling this, whoever it was on solo cornet, went into the army. And so I moved up to the end chair. George Thompson was the conductor in those days. And I remember we went to Bellevue, it would be, was it 1940 or 41? 41, perhaps. We went to Bellevue and we were third, the first attempt. I also did, around that time, City of Coventry did the very first broadcast, which I remember very well. Went to Birmingham. The BBC studios in Birmingham in those days was in Corporation Street. Why I remember the Corporation Street? I do. It was in Corporation Street, Birmingham. BBC studios. The very first broadcast. I remember the overture we played, but I cannot remember the name of it. I could play the cornet part now, if I could play the cornet, which I can't. No, I can't play at all now.
Oh, no.
The last time I tried was a couple of years ago, and I put it down in disgust.
Oh, dear.
The only thing I do now, about once a year, I get the trumpet and the cornet out, open the case, grease the slides, make sure the ferrules are work properly, you know, not too tight. Put them back in the case. That's all I do.
Come back to Coventry. George Thompson left Coventry to take over at Grimethorpe, and you followed. You moved around quite a lot in those early years. It was at this point you had to leave home and to be in Grimethorpe. What was that like?
Actually, I didn't really want to go.
Oh.
But I was 16, and in those days did what my father wanted me to do. But anyway, that's not to say I didn't enjoy my days. George Thompson asked my dad, he wanted me there. And my dad said, yes, he can go. You know. So off I went to Grantham. That was obviously the best band I'd played with up to that point.
Yeah, you were bumper up there to start with.
I was bumper up to a guy called Wynne Moore. I never actually played as a stand-up soloist while I was at Coventry, but that was my start with Grindthorpe. I remember the first solo I ever played, and I remember where I played it, with Grindthorpe, that is, in York, where it was Sunday afternoon, and I played that show.
Oh.
And that was the first time I'd played a stand-up solo. And I worked to get it from memory, and I was determined I was going to start. So I played at Grindthorpe, I think it was 1945, the year the war ended. We played at the very first Brick House Mass Band concert that was organised. And of course that's a famous in Huddersfield Town Hall. I always remember Dennis Wright conducted, or was it Eric Ball? Could have been Eric Ball. And the three bands were Brick House, of course, Wingates, and Grindthorpe, and I also played on the second one in 1946. There was a young boy who played a cornet solo from Brick House, and he played Holy City, and his name was Derek Yarside.
Yeah.
And he was 15 years old. I remember it very clearly. And he got a lovely sound, I always remember. And the rest, as they say, is history as far as Derek's concerned. You know, that was my first meeting with Derek Garside.
In 1947, you were on the move again. And you joined the band you so admired when they won the 1935 Nationals at the Crystal Palace, Munn and Feltons.
Oh, yes.
With musical director Stanley Boddington.
Yeah.
Again, you went in on the assistant principal seat and moved up to the end seat. This was becoming a habit. Could you describe your audition to join the band, the job that went with it, and what was it like working with Stanley Boddington?
This is rather amusing. My audition was in the factory, and Mr. Fred Felton was present, Stanley Boddington. You'll never believe what he asked me to play. He said, James, I want you to play the national anthem.
Oh.
Yeah. He actually said, will you play me the national anthem? I just played it. And he had his reasons, of course. And I've thought since, yeah, he just wanted to see how I played something slowish to start with. Then it said, what would you play something. Eric, would you like to play an Everest? So I played Carnival of Venice, and I just played it. And no music, of course. And he put up two or three things, sight reading, which I never had any trouble sight reading. So then I had a private interview with Mr. Fred Felton, who was the boss. And he said, now then, James, Mr. Boddington tells me he's quite happy with you and he'd like you to join us. What do you do? Well, I have worked in an office. Yeah, well, I'm going to put you, if you come here, I'm going to put you in our leather room. That's where I started. I eventually ended up in the office, where I had a job in the office. But I started off in the leather room, which was the room where they had shelves full of leather, rolls of leather. Some of it was calf leather, which was made for the best shoes, of course. Lovely leather. And I spent a few months there, but eventually I ended up in there. And as far as being bumper up, yes, I was bumper up. You see, I had a different view too, and I've always had this view. So I was second man. So what? I was interested in solo playing. And I didn't see why there was a problem about, I was in the second chair, and so it became a habit for me to play solos. The solo corner player was Hugh Higgins, who was a good player, very good player, good sound. And I spent some years just sitting there, and I was, but Stanley gradually made me into the soloist, the stand-up soloist. And then that had been my ambition since I was 7 years old,
yeah,
when I saw Lionel Jackson, and I finally made it with
fantastic.
You see, I always had this view, so I'm second man, so what? I'm the featured soloist. When I think about bands like the big band business, like bands like Stan Kenton, who were the world-class bands, they had four trumpet players. They were all soloists.
Yeah.
You know, why not? Why can't it be the same with the brass band? Of course, we all know why. You know, there are that many top-class players. But I didn't see why there was a problem with it.
What was the discipline and punctuality and dress code like at Men and Felton's?
It was a different world. You could not imagine. We used to say there was only one excuse for not attending rehearsals. That's if you were dead. This was the real days of company bands. It was your job to be at rehearsal. Yeah, had to be. And I always remember we used to have to go up the stairs. There was a canteen that they used for rehearsals. There was a clock at one end. And when I first went to one of those clock, I had a little plaque underneath it, black and white. And it said, and this in printed letters, big printed letters, always on time, harmony sublime.
Ah, that's brilliant. There's a few conductors about now who should have a clock like that in the band room.
Yeah. Always on time, harmony sublime. And that was still in place. That had been there since before the war, I was told. But it was still in place then. It didn't last because we moved band room, but it was very clear.
What was the band's concert and contest schedule like? You were away all the time, or?
As far as concert concerned, winter months, we didn't do all that much work, like a lot of bands are now. The winter's the concert season, virtually, for top-class bands. Those days was a little bit different. We did travel before motorways, but the real travelling was done in the summer months. As a matter of fact, the year I joined Men and Felton's, 1947, the band were away for 8 weeks. And in 1948, the following year, 10 weeks.
Good grief.
Well, that was my first 2 years, 47, and we were away for 8 weeks. Played for a week in Worthing, 2 weeks in London, Hyde Park, an embankment. Go up to Scarborough, we'd have a couple of weeks in Scarborough playing on the lake, Peasholm Park. Glasgow for a week, Dunfermline for a week, Edinburgh, Prince's Street Gardens for a week. Oh, this is continuous.
You must have had a lot of downtime as well then. You were playing all the time, and if you're away for weeks on end.
Oh, yes, that's right. Mornings, invariably, except for Scarborough. At Scarborough, you had to play three times a day. Huh? Morning, afternoon and evening. So the day was spent looking band equipment around. In Scarborough, we would play on the bathing pool in the South Bay in the morning. And then all the equipment had to get to the Peasholm Park for the afternoon and evening. And then the coach would go around dropping people off for the digs. Sure. Because we all had our own digs. I remember there was four of us used to stay with a lady who was from Northamptonshire. That's probably why we stayed there, because we were from Northamptonshire.
Yeah.
We used to have to nip home at lunch, back down to the walk down to the park, afternoon concert, and then on Saturday evening we didn't have a concert because the council took the view it was the change round as it was in those days.
Oh, right, yeah.
Saturday, nobody went on holiday except in on Saturday.
Yeah.
In those days.
Yeah.
So we had a Saturday evening off. That band, they could play anything. They were like a machine. Us go to London. While we were in London, I remember once Harry Mortimer came along, because he used to visit us occasionally in those days. And we did a broadcast. And we were still being told what we were going to do as far as repeats or no repeats. Dal Senya's no repeats in this time. In other words, he'd come in cold, and that was live. We're not talking about recordings now. That was a live broadcast. And he was saying, I will watch the clock. If I do this, you don't repeat.
That puts the edge on it a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah. And that was the way they did things. We did things in those, things like that. Of course, we'd been together for so long. He had the faith in the band to do it.
Yeah.
You cannot imagine now.
No. I wouldn't want to imagine it.
No, that's right. Yeah.
And there was an incident when the band were playing under a marquee in Plymouth in really bad weather and a problem with the bus.
Oh, yes. In Plymouth Hall. And on the Sunday, our first concert in Scarborough. So, in fact, we were due to travel through the night to report for duty, as it were, at Scarborough. Imagine that. This is before the motorways. This is the kind of travelling we used to do. I remember very clearly. We had our meal on the Saturday night, loaded the coach after the concert. We'd been warned that there was some bad weather approaching. Up to then, the weather was all right. We started on our journey. It was a series of mishaps because the band's coach, just outside Exeter, the brakes failed. And we were going now. I can remember now Stanley Buddingham was sitting right at the front of the coach. And he was telling the driver, why don't you just, because we're on a country road, hedges at each side, drive into the hedge to try and stop, which he did. Well, to cut a long story short, fortunately, there were no injuries or anything. He managed to stop the coach, and the boss, he used to sometimes visit us, which he had done that day. When I say the boss, I mean Mr. Felton, in his Rolls Royce. And he went ahead and found a hotel in Exeter that had no room, but they allowed us to sleep on the dining room floor. Would you believe? The band actually kept down on the dining room floor of this hotel in Exeter. And he had to telegraph ahead to council in Scarborough to say, we're very sorry. Now, on that same Saturday evening, because the weather was very bad, there was a terrific wind, and we'd been playing in a marquee on Plymouth Hoe. It blew the marquee into the sea.
Dear me.
And so, and we'd only played a concert there a few hours before. We learned that when we were in Exeter in the hotel. So we had to miss our first concert in Scarborough the next day, which was a Sunday.
Oh dear. You retired from playing after winning the Soloist Championships of Great Britain in 1959-1960. Why did you decide to finish your playing career when you were at the top of your game?
Yes, that's true, I was. Well, you know, I'd been in company bands since I was a boy. Somehow I had this feeling. I'd seen what happens, which is really, you spend your life playing for a company band. If you're on an N-chair or you're a soloist, the day inevitably comes, declining ability, and you start sliding down the line. And another thing, I played under Stanley Boddington for so long. I played under Harry Mortimer. I'd always had this view, listen, look, and keep this closed, keep the mouth closed. And I'd always done that, you know. And I thought, yeah, I think I would like to do that. I think perhaps I might be able to do that. So all these things combined, now what am I going to do? I didn't just walk out and start conducting. I had a letter one day, the year I'd won the championship at Cornet for the second time, 1960, just before the area. And it was from the managing director of the shipbuilding company at Camel Lead, wondering if I'd be interested in talking to them. They were looking for a bandmaster. Actually, he phoned and he said, yes, we're looking for a professional conductor. We're only in the third section, but our conductor is Rex Mortimer. He's a professional. What do you mean? He says, come and see us. So I did go and see him. And I met Rex and had a talk to him. I was just going as the bandmaster. Anyway, it all happened that way. And everybody thought I was crazy. What on earth are you thinking you're doing? You know, I remember Harry Mortimer saying to me, James, remember? No, not James. Jimmy. He always called me Jimmy. He said, Jimmy, all that glisters is not gold. I said, yeah, I know. But I felt that somehow this was right for me to do. And I wanted to conduct. I decided to up sticks and go, which I did. But of course, I worked like a madman, I must say, at Camel Lead. I was determined. Once or twice I thought, what have I done? But I worked out. And I was only there about a year. We won the third section, got into the second section. And Rex left. Because I think something had been said at Foden's, you know, when he gets to the top section. We don't want this band interfering. But anyway, Rex left, and so I continued working. Got one or two better players, and we won the area, 1964, and our first attempt at the Albert Hall. We were fourth.
That's right, yeah.
On variations on the ninth.
That's a good result. Yeah.
And then in 1965, runners up to Fairley. They won on Triumph and Rhapsody. We were second. So they worked.
And your most successful national result as a conductor came with Brighouse and Rastrick. I'd imagine it was a joy to work on Hubert Bath's Freedom.
Oh, it was. We did quite a lot of section of rehearsals, of course, as people did and do still. As a matter of fact, I had a visit a couple of weeks ago from Les Beavers, who was chairman in those days, and Gary Cutt. Gary Cutt worked with me when he was a young man, you know, well in his 50s now, of course, very successful young conductor. They visited me, Les and Gary, as they do from time to time. Les was saying, is it right that when you did rehearsals on Freedom, section of rehearsals, you got your cornet out and played for them? Said, well, actually, yes, it is. He said, we heard all about it. And he said, about you opening your briefcase and bringing this little cornet out. We worked very hard on Freedom. And Les reminded me when he came to see me. It came together only a couple of days before the Albert Hall. Not for the first time, of course. These things happen. Things are not going so well. Then suddenly, cogs seemed to get together and it worked. And of course, on the day, it certainly did work.
Yes.
Yeah. It was a very, very good performance.
You venture into adjudication and the year Corey won the national treble in 1984 was the first time you were invited to adjudicate the nationals alongside William Relton and David Wilcox. What was that like for you? And as a point of interest, what is it really like in the box, acoustically, in the Albert Hall?
I remember Sir David was a charming man, very straightforward. He was a delightful man, I thought. As a matter of fact, he was head of the Royal College of Music when my wife was there. Yes, so, well, that's another story. But I remember starting adjudicating, like I did with conducting. I started at the bottom. Peter Wilson was editor in those days.
That's right, yeah.
And after the band had won, Peter said to me, well, I think you should start adjudicating. I said, no, I'm not really bothered, Peter. I said, I'll do another few years. He says, no, I really think you should. Anyway, he persuaded me. And I always remember very first adjudicating job I did was the second section in the northern area. And that was the first one I ever did. So then things snowballed a little bit. And yes, I ended up, first time I adjudicated at the Albert Hall. Acoustically, I never had a problem. I've always said, whatever the circumstances, the cream will rise to the top.
I'm going to go back to your conducting now. If I mention Peasholme Park as a conductor, does it bring back a soggy memory?
Yeah, we had a band sergeant, because he was responsible for general discipline. Arthur Ethorne, his name, was one of the bass players. Because we had to row from the landing stage over to the bandstand in Peasholme Park, I think that there was a couple of rowing boats. You know, it's crazy when you think about it now. But it's still there as far as I know, because the bandstand is in the water. So we were rowed out half an hour to get the band on the stage. We were rowed out with a couple of these rowing boats. Because you had to be careful. You were stepping out of the side of the boat onto the stage. The danger was always obvious, to be careful. For some reason, it had to be me. And as I went to step onto the stage, something happened. I always had my suspicions, but something happened, and it just gradually moved away. And my foot went straight into the water, down. Fortunately, it was only a couple of feet deep, but that was enough. I ended up with both legs in the water, up to my knees.
Oh, dear. Okay, the Kings of Brass was a happy 7 years of your life. Who came up with the idea, and what was the criteria for membership?
Yes, actually, that 7 years was a joy.
I bet.
An absolute joy. Anyway, it was in 1994. I got a call from Les Beavers, and he said, "Jim, how would you like to conduct a band called the Kings of Brass?" "Yes, I have to say yes. Sounds interesting." So he went on. And he said, "Well, you know the Navigation Inn in Saddleworth, which is what we always used to use as the brass band inn. And in fact, I know that in those days, few players from Dyke, few players from Brighouse, they would very often meet up there. Some would be on the way home after rehearsal. In fact, the landlord was Ian Gibson, who now lives in Spain and has done for several years. But he was the landlord there. Corner player, you know. It was a brass band pub, in other words. So Les, Geoffrey Whittam, Brian Evans, soprano player, several players of that ilk, you know, either played with Brighouse or had played with them. And they were together once in the Navigation Inn. And they were talking, as I'm sure as everybody knows, all over the country have talked about, "How about such and such a player? What do you think? Is he still around? Is he still playing?" Geoffrey said, "Why don't we have a band?" All these players, you know. He played with Fairies, he played with Brighouse, he played with Dyke. Now we could have a good band, couldn't we? All but they'd all finished by that. I believe it was Brian Evans, the soprano player, said, "Wait a minute, why don't we do it?" So that was the beginning of the Kings of Brass. They talked about it and they said, "Who shall we ask?" Well, they went around all the names, ex-Dyke, ex-Brighouse, Monofeltons, had two trombone players from Monofeltons, Maxwell Thornton, who was first trombone in my day. Then Les rang me. So it was all arranged. We had an initial rehearsal. The criteria, it was obviously had to be very good players, still playing well, but not necessarily in any of the bands, you know. It was supposed to be a veterans band. I think the youngest was late 30s, but mostly they were all 50s and 60s. They had to be the right type, we all knew.
As a youngster, you had few academic qualifications, but decided to study at the Open University with a degree in art at the age of 69.
Yes.
This had me intrigued. What made you decide to do this?
Well, I'd left school at 14. As we did in those days, no other qualifications. In other words, it was virtually an elementary education, that's all. Throughout my adult life, and I always felt that I'd missed out on an education, which I had, no doubt about it. I mean, music was my saviour. After I retired, I sat here one day reading the paper. I saw the Open University advert and I thought, right, I'm going to do something about this. I don't want to go into music, I've spent my life in music. So I sent off for the pack and I thought, no, art, humanities, I think I will go for that. European history and literature, as back as far as Shakespeare. And I think the last year, I always remember the last year, was spent in democracy and the state. And it was about ancient Greece. And that was the last year, the fifth year I did. So then, yes, I got through all that.
Brilliant.
And when I was 74, I graduated.
I hope you enjoyed the first part of the interview with James Scott. I found it fascinating as he charted his life through an amazing career in brass banding. In the second part of the interview, which will be posted shortly, I asked James Scott specific questions posed by you, the listeners, and some of my own. He provides some interesting views on the age-old argument of open versus closed adjudication, and recalls his audition for the end seat in Foden's with Harry Mortimer and Harry's father in the back room of their post office. Don't forget to tune in to the next edition of the podcast. If you'd like to be kept up to date with future articles and podcasts, just sign up to the Nezzy on Brass newsletter and also receive automatic entry to all future prize draws. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you on the next podcast.